Rocks don't do it. Doesn't seem like bacteria, fungi, or plants do it. Fish, birds, lizards. We tend to think they don't do it, or if they do, it seems like it must be very modestly. Human beings, though, are big into contemplation and wonder. Not only are we here, just as the rock and the lizard are, but we notice that we are here. And we wonder, what is going on here? What is this reality? We apply our distinctive sort of intelligence, not just to strategies for survival, but to ideas about our place in the grand scheme. We want and need a framework of meaning. We all know this, and yet I think we seldom appreciate how fantastic that is. In answer to this wondering, every culture has a sacred story, a creation myth. These stories tell how a god or goddess or primordial force formed the land and the water, how the plants and animals came to be, how the first humans came to be, the ancient ancestors. It tells us what our relation is to the animals, to the sun, to the moon, and the stars. Often the story tells how humanity came to possess its most marvelous gifts, language, fire, tools, sexuality, and procreation. Incredible gifts, all. These creation stories have been told around a campfire by tribal elders through hundreds of generations, through thousands of generations, presumptively originating with the ancient ancestors themselves. The stories, we may safely suppose, varied and evolved over time, retaining those elements which resonated deeply in the primal human imagination. Many of them faded into the mists as the people who carried the stories perished or were absorbed into other cultures, or as other stories came along which claimed a greater share of their imagination and replaced the old stories. As we developed written language, these stories were among the first things recorded, and in the process, they became more standardized. In some cases, specific renderings were codified as sacred scripture, the official, unchanging version of the story. Since then, on occasion, new material has been added, which didn't come down verbally from deeply ancient sources, but was revealed all of a sudden to certain living individuals through a divine visitation, a vision, a dream, or a trance. Some of these new revelations came to be regarded as special messages from God and designated as scripture. Now, each time such a new revelation is received, the people say, "Wow! This changes everything. This changes what we think is really going on here. It changes what we think life is and what we imagine about death. It changes our relationship to the animals and plants and the rocks and hills. It changes how we think about our people and other people." The Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Mormon, and indigenous traditions all illustrate this pattern. Wow, this changes everything. Many of the ancient stories have portrayed the author of creation in human-like form. In other words, we have imagined the source of all creation as being like ourselves. Turning that around, there has been a sense that we have in our nature something of the mystery of creation, and that we are like the gods or like God above nature. Now, in about the last 400 years, and especially in the last 100 years, a new story is being revealed, a very different story. It's not a special revelation sent by God to a chosen individual. The new story is emerging gradually through the careful observation of nature. Instead of fixating on one of the many unique messages which the various traditions claim to have received from the Creator, we are now looking at the huge message that we have all undeniably received from the source of creation. That would be creation itself, the natural universe. For the first 300 years, the careful observation of nature told us some amazing things. It said that all matter is attracted to all other matter, and in a consistent way. We call this feature of reality gravity. Though we have named it, we still have no idea why everything is attracted to everything else. But it seems meaningful that our universe is this way. It has been revealed that instead of the sun gliding across a curved dome over a flat ground, as it appears to the casual observation, that actually the Earth is a spherical planet flying around the sun. And that our sun is a star, the same as those myriad tiny points of light which fill the night sky. That we are not the center of existence, and that existence is much, much vaster than we had been imagining. Careful observation suggested that everything is composed of inert, self-contained particles, which are hard and immutable, like billiard balls. We call these particles atoms. The new revelation told us that all life on Earth, including ourselves, is one continuous evolving process determined by the invariable laws of chemistry and by chance variations in the environment, all of which is devoid of purpose or creativity. It's determined. This mechanical universe story staked a powerful claim on human belief, partly because it enabled us to predict and control events to an impressive degree through technology that has come about based upon looking at the natural universe this way. And because, unlike other creation stories, there was evidence which was verifiable. It was not just the private experience of one individual or a belief stipulated by a particular culture. Americans, Arabs, Chinese, or anyone could see the same picture through the careful observation of nature. But what did this mechanical universe story tell us is going on here? What did it say about our place in the grand scheme? Well, it said that the universe is just the mindless, invariable cranking of a giant machine. It said that nothing worthy of reverence is going on here. that nothing is sacred, really. That we ourselves are tiny, insignificant machines, which, strangely and for reasons unknown, happen to be prone to self-congratulatory imaginings. It is said that we can learn to use the universe machine for our purposes, but that the whole thing, including our purposes, is ultimately as meaningless as the ticking of a clock. And so we must either A, buck up and face the pointlessness of it all, or B, generate an imaginary sense of meaning and find comfort in that way, even knowing that it's all really just a fantasy. That is more or less where it stood around the year 1900. A rather dismal picture, wouldn't you say? Small wonder traditional religions have tended to reject this and stick to their specially revealed stories. But in just about the last century or so, the careful observation of nature has been painting a picture that is different in important ways, although it retains some of those features. It has spouted geysers of mystery and wonder. Now, it tells us that the entire universe emerged from a single tiny point, an infinitesimally tiny point, within which all matter and all energy was an undifferentiated oneness, or singularity, they call it. It's just one, we don't have a word for what it was, because it's sort of everything mushed. It doesn't have the forms that we speak of today. A oneness, a singularity, a mysterious sort of mode or place, if we can use those words, in which time did not exist. It tells us that the myriad stars constantly send out signals in all directions to the farthest reaches of our still expanding universe, sending out signals full of information about themselves. The universe communicates superabundantly. It tells us that there are, scattered about the universe, incomprehensibly tiny points called black holes, into which matter and energy are rushing, disappearing into a vortex of mystery. Strange counterpoints to the mysterious origin of the universe, where everything flew out from an incomprehensibly tiny point. It tells us that all living things on Earth share a microscopic chemical code, which we call DNA, which guides the formation of new individuals down to fine detail, and by which the enterprise of life maintains continuity across generations. It says that all life on Earth today is literally descended from a common ancestor by a gradual evolution and differentiation. In the last century, the careful observation of nature has been telling us that matter and energy are two different ways of looking at the same thing, and that those particles of matter we've been talking about, far from being solid like billiard balls, actually oscillate in and out of existence millions of times per second. It tells us that the intermixing and interdependence of divergent life forms is total. The eating and excreting, the dying and decaying of each living thing depends on many other life forms, and all of that taken together creates the conditions of life for many other life forms. And that this process goes on even inside our own bodies. We call this radically interdependent set of relationships, ecology. Nothing exists independently, but it's all entwined. Ecology. It tells us that the physical laws of the universe, if they were even slightly different than they are, for instance, if gravity was a little bit stronger than it is, or a little weaker than it is, then the galaxies and stars and planets could not have formed. And life in this universe would be an impossibility. In other words, the careful observation of nature now proclaims a profound, seamless unity, a cauldron of creativity and mystery, a universe minutely calibrated to be suitable for the development of life. And it implies, without actually saying, that our particular sentience and our heightened powers of observation are the universe reflecting upon itself. And I dare say, delighting in itself. This somewhat verifiable universal creation story presents us with a reality that is worthy of reverence, and one in which we have a profound role to play. Now, the systematic enterprise of carefully observing nature, which we call science, does not say anything directly about reverence, because the discipline of science leaves aside questions of meaning and feelings like reverence. Indeed, practitioners of science have historically been more inclined to denigrate questions of meaning. But the reality which science reveals, the reality which science is revealing to us, is so breathtakingly magnificent, so pregnant with existential transcendence, so much more awe-inspiring than the old anthropomorphic tales, that it will take us generations to learn how to worship accordingly. If I was going to found a religion based on this new revelation, I might like to call it Unitary Universism. But that would probably not be a good idea, because of the similarity to the name of another religious group you may have heard of. And anyway, another ism is probably not what the world needs. But when I'm thinking about this new picture and what it tells us about reality and the place of humanity in the cosmic scheme, I call it Great Mystery Theology. Great Mystery Theology. This name might help us keep a humble and reverent attitude. The great mystery is not something to try to explain away, or to define in terms that make it a reflection of ourselves, which we're very prone to do. Let's let it be a mystery and acknowledge its greatness. Our understanding of it will change over time, but the reality will, we may happily suppose, ever exceed our understanding. As it happens, a web is quite a good image for this. A web is utterly connected and interwoven in many directions, just like the ecology of life on Earth. And anything that happens on a web, if you touch it, it carries vibrational signals out in all directions, as is the case with our universe. A web suggests the paradox of a seamless whole, which yet contains meaningful distinctions. In the web, like the strands and segments, and the intersections where they meet are distinctive, right? They're distinguishable from one another, but the web itself is seamless and whole. This corresponds to the way we experience ourselves as distinct individuals. We do. Right? I rarely get confused that I'm me and you're you. I mean, we get that distinction, right? And yet we also intuit that we're somehow one with all that is. Now, whatever we call this new way of looking at reality and ourselves, we are in the midst of learning to respond spiritually to this marvelous new revelation. Humanity is in the process of saying, once again, wow, this changes everything. And again, it's taking generations to develop a proper response, just as it has with all the prior great revelations. Great mystery theology does not require special expertise in science and mathematics, any more than being a Christian requires mastery of the ancient Greek and Hebrew languages in which its special revelations are recorded. Somebody needs to know those things. That would be scholars. But devotional life does not require the ability to do original research. Our seventh UU principle is respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. And that is a big step in the right direction, putting interdependent web of existence in our statement about reality. At the same time, I confess I find it somewhat humorous to use the word respect to describe our attitude toward this fabulous oneness of everything. I invite you to gaze into the infinity of the night sky. Picture that. Think about the superabundance and super interdependence of life on Earth. Every kind of creature and plant and being and bacterium and fungus all together generating the life of this earth. Consider the astonishing reality of your own body. Trillions and trillions of cells and many more trillions of bacteria all interacting very intelligently to maintain the delicate condition we call being alive. Think of how every living cell, too small for us to see, itself contains a universe of atoms. Trillions of trillions and trillions of atoms, which are themselves vast empty spaces with tiny, tiny particles, so-called particles, that cycle in and out of existence many millions of times per second. In pondering all of this, can respect be the appropriate word? For myself, when I stop to contemplate the great mystery, I am moved to tears of reverent gratitude. Reverence for the interdependent web of all existence. That would be much better, in my view. I feel like the implications of all this are hidden in plain view, known in the mind, but not realized in the heart very often. I want to fall on my knees and pray. But our tradition has not taught us how to do that in relation to this kind of magnificence. So we will have to learn new ways to pray. Everything in the universe is part of the stupendous whole, and yet there is something special about self-awareness, that kind of knowing that has as its content, I am. Knowing I am. Which, if you stop and think about it for a second, right now, I'm sure you will have that experience. Okay? You know that you are. Humanity has long sensed the specialness of that. And that's why we have felt ourselves to be like the gods and in some sense above nature. It is our self-awareness. It's beginning to appear that some mammals and birds have self-awareness to some degree. But even if it's not fully unique to humans, self-awareness is something special. And we do seem to have it more fulsomely than most other animals. And recently, as I've been describing, we've begun to perceive mysteries far above and far below our level of existence. What does it mean for a creature such as ourselves to contemplate cells and atoms? That's quite a leap. What does it mean for us to know about galaxies and black holes? By analogy, it's as if one of our blood cells had begun to think about swing dancing. Or began to develop an opinion about the outcome of the next election. It's an astonishing shift of levels. You know, a blood cell thinking about that kind of stuff, that's like us becoming able to contemplate these things. And we are in the midst of that kind of shift. If humanity has a purpose, I'm convinced it has to do with being sentient. It's not about being, as in that old Monty Python skit, which some of you might remember, a royal society for putting things on top of other things. The universe does not need human beings to build clever things. It already has things far more magnificent. It surely does not profit from us achieving success within a social order that we ourselves have created. But it may make a meaningful difference for us to bear witness, reverent witness, to the miracle of creation. To experience with richness and depth. If we have a common purpose, I think it is something experiential. To worship, to pray, to experience communion, to realize our place in the cosmic scheme. We yearn to experience ourselves as participants in the cosmic order, and for very good reason. We are participants in the cosmic order. Even before the careful observation of nature revealed the unity and grandeur of the cosmos to our conscious, reasoning minds, some among us have had intuitions on it. Mystics in many cultures, ages, and religious traditions have caught glimpses of the ineffable mystery and deep oneness of reality, and continue to do so today. It stands to reason. If indeed we are part of a seamless reality, and we are aware, why wouldn't we have intuitive knowledge of that deep truth? Think about how your body knows very well how to walk, how to kidney, how to perspire. Even though your conscious thinking mind could not say how it's done. We don't know, and yet we do know. The universe is living in each of us, experiencing through each of us, right now. The vastness of the ocean, the infinity of the sky, the universes within. We contemplate them in awe, and deep inside we know that we are none other. Songwriter Peter Mayer sings of how when he was a boy going to church, only churchy things seemed sacred. But now, being awake to the magnificence of this universe, everything is holy. So he says, wine from water is not so small, but an even better magic trick is that anything is here at all. So the challenging thing becomes not to look for miracles, but to find where there isn't one. Read a questioning child's face and say it's not a testament. That'd be very hard to say. See another new morning come and say it's not a sacrament. I tell you, it can't be done. This morning I stood outside and saw a little red-winged bird, shining like a burning bush, singing like a scripture verse. It made me want to bow my head. I remember when church let out, how things have changed since then. Everything is holy now. It used to be a world half there, heaven's second-rate hand-me-down. But I walk it with a reverent air, because everything is holy now.